Today we'll be discussing the Just for Laughs Festival, and we'll be discussing medical tourism. This is Doctor versus Comedian. I'm Dr. Asif Doja, and this is the Doctor of Laughs.
Not a real doctor.
Ali Hassan. Every episode, I pick a topic for Ali from comedy and entertainment, and I question him about it. Then Ali picks a topic for medicine and health and grills me on that topic. Today, we'll be discussing the Just for Laughs Festival and its recent financial troubles. And then we'll be discussing medical tourism. But before that, Ali, we need to have a little follow-up about our Oscars predictions from last month. Now, we guaranteed you that we were going to get all of those major categories correct.
I don't know if I guaranteed anybody anything. I barely remember anything I said that day. But okay, what did we do wrong?
So between the two of us, I said we would be correct. So Best Actor, Best Picture, that was Oppenheimer and Cillian Murphy. And Best Supporting Actress, we were right. Devin Joy Randolph from The Holdovers. Best Supporting Actor, Robert Downey Jr. We were correct in this. In fact, I was correct in saying Emma Stone, Poor Things. A lot of people thought that was an upset, but this guy.
Not that
right
guy.
Here, yep. This guy predicted it. But the screenplays, we really fell on our faces there. Best Original Screenplay went to Anatomy of a Fall, and Best Adapted Screenplay went to American Fiction.
I was going to say that.
You know, and for American Fiction, they're both very clever movies, Anatomy of a Fall and American Fiction. American Fiction, really kind of clever movie about a black author who's basically pandering to what white people want from black authors. It's such a well-done movie. So it's kind of interesting that it won the Best Adapted Screenplay, but it's quite clever. But I think we had said The Holdovers for one of the screenplay nominations. And of course, Aldi sent me an article saying that there's a lot of controversy about this because basically Alexander Payne's Holdovers was accused of plagiarism by a writer named Simon Stevenson, who wrote Luca, that Pixar movie Luca.
Sure.
And he also wrote Paddington 2. So this guy knows what he's doing. And he has proof that Alexander Payne got a copy of his script. It's a script called Frisco.
I like that Paddington 2 suggests that this guy knows what he's doing. But anyway, okay.
Paddington 2 are amazing movies, Ali. Have you not seen them?
I've seen parts of Paddington 1 while my children were watching it. Amazing.
Okay. Very strong. Dismissive. Very dismissive.
Okay, that's fine. So this guy does know what he's doing. I retract my heckle.
Yeah, and he has proof that Alexander Payne read his script on two separate occasions. And he says, I'll read you a quote from him. There's a Good Variety article, which basically goes over the whole case in general. This is what he says, a Stevenson guy. I've been a working writer for 20 years in my native UK before I came to the US. So I'm aware that people can have surprisingly similar ideas and sometimes a few elements can be borrowed, etc. This is not that situation. The two screenplays are forensically identical and riddled with unique smoking guns throughout. So basically he said he couldn't believe it. There's some things that he said are unaltered and remain visibly identical in the layout on the page of the scripts.
And remind me of the relationship between these two. They're friends? I mean, he read his script twice. Why did he read his script twice? What is their relationship?
They're not friends, just from his agent. You know, his agent, if you read some of these emails, they're trying to get the script produced. It was on the blacklist. Have you heard about the blacklist?
Yeah.
Ali? Yeah. These are the best unproduced screenplays in Hollywood every year they come of list. So it was on the blacklist. It's a well-known screenplay. And so if you read this article, they're trying to get John Krasinski interested. They're trying to get Bob Odenkirk interested. Like, yeah, we think maybe Krasinski would direct it. Maybe Odenkirk would play the school teacher. We'll try to find somebody for this. So it was kind of being shopped around by his agents to see if anybody would be interested. And that's how it got into Alexander Payne's hands. So anyway, we'll see how it goes. Apparently it's very tough to prove these things in court, but we'll see how it goes. So anyway, yeah, so that's probably a reason why maybe it's best that it did not win and our prediction was incorrect.
So we're smart after all.
So Ali, let's get going with our first topic. And I was a bit surprised. There's some news that came out about the Just for Laughs Festival being in some financial trouble. And so, to say the least.
You were a bit surprised, were you? Yeah, financial trouble is a gross understatement here. I'm in financial trouble. I can't find my wallet. I'm in financial trouble. This is like very serious.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Maybe tell us a bit about the Just for Laughs Festival. What's the history of the festival? Why is it so important?
Yes. Well, you know, look, I'll give you the perspective of a Montrealer, a proud Quebecer, you know, and somebody who loved what it did for the province and the city he lived in, and then also the perspective of a comedian. So Just for Laughs has been around as long as I can remember. The exact time was in 1983. It was founded in French. Then 1985, they developed the English portion of it. And it was a guy named Andy Nullman who still would be seen from time to time. He's like no longer involved directly with the festival, but he was sort of always around. You know, you found something, they let you hang around everywhere and do whatever you like. So, but he's sort of the royalty, and we have him to thank for the, he's the brainchild of Just for Laughs, as far as I understood it. He, in the late 90s, he left. He was no longer part of the full-time festival staff. He would just do the galas. And so we watched it grow in a significant way. From like, it was a 2-day French language event when it started. And by the end, it was 30 days, you know, 2 weeks plus more for the English side, 2 weeks plus more, depending on what shows you're watching for the French side. So it was like the entire month. And I mentioned that specifically because it's important to consider what it meant for the economy of Montreal and Quebec in general. You know, people base their vacations around this. And so this is like a massive, massive hit. Tourism, hotel, restaurants, all this kind of stuff that, you know, whatever, parking, whatever you think. Everything in the tourism world is taking a massive hit, which is what makes it even more surprising. It became sort of synonymous with Montreal. In fact, when you hear American comedians talk about Just for Laughs, they would say, we're going to the Montreal Festival. They wouldn't even say Just for Laughs. It was obvious that it was Just for Laughs. They don't have any connection to the words Just for Laughs. For them, it was the Montreal Festival. It was a weekend in Montreal or a week in Montreal or longer. So it just became this incredible thing. It had these offshoots. Many of you know, for better or for worse, the Just for Laughs gag show. I have a nice connection with it because my sister and my father used to sit and laugh at that together. But it was always this weird thing. Like, this is not good. At some point, someone is going to need CPR, like actual help in the streets of Montreal. I think
for some of our listeners, especially people in America who may not have seen these Just for Laughs gags, it's like a half hour show. It's like a prank show, right, Ali?
And it was 100% prank show shot around the city of Montreal. You get duped into doing something, and then all of a sudden they go, ah, you're on Just for Laughs gags. But some of this stuff was like kind of crazy. It was a little bit crazy. And I really was like, someone is going to be in, they're going to be bleeding out their ears and in need of actual help. And people are going to go, no, that's probably a gag. Not going to help that person.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, it had a very French sensibility to it, a very Quebecois sensibility, which
that's
I
not
was
always
kind of
a compliment. I don't know if Asif means that as a compliment.
I was trying to make it as a compliment. Yes. And the other thing, it was usually done without words. So it was almost like a little, these little silent movies. Think about Mr. Bean, right? Mr. Bean, the comedy is all silent. There's very little dialogue in a Mr. Bean thing. That's kind of the way these pranks are. You could watch it and you don't have to know French, obviously, because there's no dialogue. And so these Just for Laughs gags, you would see them being actually shown not just in Canada but in other countries around the world, because it had this universal language, because it was just kind of physical comedy and pranks.
Exactly right. So it was something that could be rebroadcast all over the world. That's just part of its growth. Also, you know, in 2007, Just for Laughs started. It turned 25 and it launched a Toronto version of the festival. And there was talk up until very recently that Just for Laughs may shift completely from Montreal to make its headquarters in Toronto. They started a Chicago edition as well, which was sponsored by TBS, the US cable network. They were in Australia, and I believe it was Melbourne. They had Just for Laughs Australia happening there. They did, I think it was just once or twice, they did Just for Laughs in London, but I believe that was part of the growth. So from that perspective, it was just growing and growing. It was a pretty, like an unstoppable force, it felt like. Until about...
Ali, before you get into the issues that Just for Laughs, or JFL, did we call it JFL?
I don't know. I'm still smarting from the rudeness of your interruption. But I think, yeah, I know what you're going to ask me. So go ahead.
I want to hear about your specific experiences there, either attending as a comedian. What about when you were up and coming? Were you trying to get a spot there? And then, you know, have you performed there otherwise?
Yeah. So Just for Laughs was this fantastic part. Just like there's the Jazz Fest in the month of June, the month of July, Montrealers were, you know, involved in some way, either trying desperately to avoid it or like part of it or attending it. It was very much part of the city I grew up in. And then when I became a comedian, it seemed like that was like, you know, just right next door, right down the street is the holy grail for comedy. And I've likened it to being like the hot girl in high school. And it was like, if she would just talk to me, if she would just notice me, she would see I'm different from the others. You know, you sort of like put it on a pedestal.
Desperation
for sure. And, you know, I made the mistake that so many young comedians make. I think I was like 2 or 3 years into comedy and already sending my clips into Just for Laughs and being like, I'm ready.
So you can't do that.
You cannot do that. You're not ready. There are a few, you know, prodigies. Dave Chappelle might have been ready at year three to be part of Just for Laughs. But anyway, it was me sort of introducing myself to them and then also getting introduced to early rejection, which is also important, I think, in this business. But eventually, you know, it was a very organic thing. It would be like, oh, we have a couple of shows happening. It's not a gala. It's not this, but it's in a tent. Part of Just for Laughs in a tent. Mm-hmm. I'm like, a tent? Sure. I'd be into the tent. You know, I'm getting the crumbs and the scraps. And then it's like, it's not Just for Laughs, but it's off Just for Laughs. This was another offshoot. Off JFL was a lot of solo shows, which I thank them for that. Muslim Interrupted, which I then took to Scotland, which I then toured across Canada for 3 years, which then became the basis of my book. I got to do 3 one-hour shows at off JFL. It was invaluable to me. And I was able to shrink it into something that I could then take to Edinburgh to do for a month. So, you know, these things were all sort of a means to an end. And then, like, for me, the greatest thrill was about a 6 week long. We did about 28 shows. And also, if you attended one of those shows, that was the tour with Rick Mercer. This was an annual thing that Just for Laughs had been putting on for the last, I'm going to say, decade. I don't know how long that was going for, but it was this Just for Laughs Presents road show. And often was American comedians with one, maybe two Canadian comedians thrown in, and they would do the Just for Laughs roadshow. So I had the thrill of being part of this all-Canadian roadshow. And I say that's a thrill because, first of all, Rick Mercer was hosting it. I was a big fan of his. And to be in the car driving from city to city or flying with him and being in airports, and I mean, he's a gifted storyteller, and listening to his stories versus, you know, I happen to know firsthand about, like, when you're in the car with American comedians, you know, Canada is like, they don't put it on any pedestal. They're just in the car going like, hey, you guys have Dunkin' Donuts around here? Like, yeah, dude, you could do your Dunkin' Donuts joke. You could also just look that up on the internet. So that's not as exciting to me. What was exciting was being with, you know, Ivan Decker, who was somebody I knew, but then became a friend of mine, and Deb DiGiovanni and Sophie Buttle, and of course, Rick Mercer, and the storytelling and the connection of that to Canada and to Just for Laughs. So that was a Just for Laughs sponsored, you know, road show. We went from coast to coast, Victoria to Newfoundland, and it was fantastic. One of the greatest thrills I've ever had. And then, you know, that was something Just for Laughs gave me the opportunity to do. And I'll forever be grateful for that. And yeah, we were in talks every year, you know, and in fact, myself and a comedian were talking recently about when you end school, September comes around and you're no longer in school, but it's still September. And you feel like there's something I got to do. Something's missing. It's because you are finally, for the first time in your life, not going back to school in a September semester. I feel like July is going to be like that for us. You know, we don't know what the future holds exactly for Just for Laughs. They've definitely canceled this year's festival. I personally feel, you know, this little bit of disbelief that there aren't, you know, government bodies coming to sort of bail them out. Worse companies have been bailed out. Chevrolet.
What was the issue? Like, it was a financial issue?
It appears to be a 100% financial issue. So I'll tell you this. We back up a little bit. In 2017, 2018, actually before that, it had come out that Gilbert Rozon, who was the festival president, one of the founders alongside of Andy Nullman, he resigned from his position after allegations of sexual misconduct. And if you read the stories, he's not a great dude. You can't spin that into anything positive. He's kind of a POS, we'll say, I know you like the censored versions of my language here, Asif.
Mm-hmm.
That he announced then in 2017 that he would sell the festival. So that was the first time we heard of any like thing about, you know, selling the festival, and he had to resign. I mean, there was sort of financial stuff in there, but it also was like, oh, maybe it's just because he wants the attention off of him. In the end, you know, Quebecor, which is a massive, massive Quebec conglomerate, huge business, they were given the right of first refusal to buy Just for Laughs. They refused. And then in 2018, Howie Mandel with ICM Partners, which is a huge talent agency in the U.S., they came forward. And people were, like, comedians were very concerned. Howie Mandel was like, no, this will stay in Montreal. It's important to the local culture there. There'll be no changes. But there's a lot of comedians, as I said, there's all these arms of Just for Laughs. So people are like, oh, I was recording an album with Just for Laughs. I was in development with a sitcom with Just for Laughs. What does this all mean? Howie Mandel sort of became the face. I would be surprised if he spent 1 cent of his own money on this. I think he didn't do that. He just decided to be the face of it. And unfortunately for Howie, you know, he's very much a Hollywood guy. He has nothing to do with Canada and comedy, and we're all very aware of that. He's not a Canadian comedian. But he released a video saying, hey, I know you're all concerned. I get it. I'm also Canadian comedian. But in the background was his, you know, staircase and his grand piano. And he's like, I'm one of you guys. And the vast majority of Canadian comedians were like, no, dude, you have a grand piano and a staircase. No Canadian comedian has those things. Get lost. You're not one of us. So it was not a good look. But anyway, I'm digressing here. But that was the first time that there was like these concerns about operations, management, finances. And that was 2017, 2018. So then, you know, the financial part might bore people, but there was the Montreal Canadiens hockey team, Bell Canada or Bell Media, as it's called. Everybody sort of got in and then resuscitated whatever, you know, was going on with Just for Laughs. And then that was it. You know, after that, we got back into it. Of course, in the pandemic, it was a much scaled down version. I performed during the pandemic. I didn't even bring that up, Asif, because it was like we were performing, you know, two shows over two nights at a drive-in theater. That was the pandemic version of Just for Laughs. So that wasn't great. It was something. Great audiences in that drive-in theater because they were desperate for comedy and we were all desperate to perform. But then, yeah, by last year, by 2022, it was back. 62 comedians. Festival was running July 13th to the 31st. It was the 40th anniversary of Just for Laughs. Everything seemed great on the surface. And when I say on the surface, I don't just mean to buffoons like me. I also mean having chatted with a few people who are friends who work at Just for Laughs. They were taken completely by surprise. It was March 5th. And in fact, I was, just to tell you how much I was taken by surprise, I was hosting Canada Reads that week. And Canada Reads ended on March 5th that day. That day we wrapped. I turn on my phone and there's a message from a news outlet saying, we'd love to talk to you about the situation with Just for Laughs. Do you have time for an interview? And I had to be like, what situation?
Oh,
like,
it
was complete. And then I called, you know, during that week, messaged a few people I know who work there. And they confirmed that they were completely. One of my friends said, I was taken by surprise, but it's not a complete shock. So he had some insider information, obviously, about the financial issues. And another person was just like, I'm in disbelief. I was, you know, I thought we were going the distance here. So, you know, the blame from Just for Laughs has been on, as is, you know, you could predict this, COVID-19 pandemic. Obviously, people have talked about that. Every single business will tell you that that was an issue. They have also put some blame on streaming services. You know, that I would say is up for debate. They have reduced budgets because, you know, networks have less money because of streaming services. Maybe then there's it's just casting uncertainty and all this kind of stuff. But then it has come out since also that they had a lot of money owing to a number of different creditors, and also Gilbert Rozon's own legal fees connected to the sexual misconduct. I think that Just for Laughs is on the hook for some of that, but also one other employee who was suing them because he was promised something by Gilbert Rozon for his archival footage. He was never given it. So these legal fees and the rest of this, you know, again, I'm in disbelief that there aren't a number of people coming to the rescue of this festival, but maybe there's some goodwill that I hoped was there that just isn't there. Some people are like, no, not worth saving. They need to learn a lesson. They got to figure themselves out. I honestly can't believe it. And I've had a lot of friends who are not comedians be like, but couldn't Jerry Seinfeld just write a check, end all these troubles? My response to that, and again, I don't, you know, take it for what it's worth as a Canadian comedian, I don't think Jerry Seinfeld cares about what happens to Just for Laughs. And when I say Jerry Seinfeld, I don't mean specifically him. I mean American comedians and the wealthy ones, their future isn't tied to Just for Laughs' future.
Sure.
Sure, they had some great sets here in the 80s and 90s that then launched their careers. But, you know, I don't know. And also Howie Mandel. People are like, I thought Howie Mandel was going to help. I don't think he would have spent a cent of his own money. A good businessman, a good business person often does not spend their own money. They get other people to spend that money. So, yeah, Just for Laughs doesn't owe them anything, and they don't owe Just for Laughs anything. So there's no benefit to other people in the U.S. saving Just for Laughs. They just turn their attention to the next festival. You know, there was a great festival called the Aspen Comedy Festival in Colorado for many years. Right. It also folded. That was prior to the pandemic, prior to they had their own issues going on. Nobody came to bail that. That was a great ski vacation and all the, what do you want to call it, the California celebrities and you know, both the coastal celebrities would flock to Aspen, and you could see Alec Baldwin on a chairlift, and you could see this person, like non-comedic celebrities there, and it was a great time. And sure, they felt like, oh, that sucks, it's gone. But they all just sort of moved on. And I think that's what people are ready to do. People in positions of power and wealth, they're ready to just sort of move on. I obviously have grown up with this festival. I have this connection to it, you know, nostalgia and also like what it means for Canada and for comedians. I would call it a pretty huge blow for this country and the comedy industry in this country. But, you know, especially as it went to, there was Just for Laughs Vancouver was getting bigger and bigger, Just for Laughs Toronto, Just for Laughs Montreal, and also Just for Laughs recording albums with comedians and being connected to Sirius XM and all this, you know, for better or worse. And I have to mention this, if it comes back, there is an opportunity for something wonderful here. We've talked about this before on this podcast. In Quebec and in America, there is something called a star system. For those of you who have not listened to us talk about that, it is the idea that an organization or a group or a person in power sees a young comedian with some promise and they say, we are going to nurture you. We're going to develop you. We're going to turn you into something, and we're going to do that so the rest of this country, or in the case of Quebec province, can enjoy you and enjoy your talent. We're fostering, we're nurturing. That has not been the reality that Just for Laughs in general has provided for Canadian comedians. Certainly not financially. I can find you a bunch of comics that have been like, Just for Laughs was amazing to me, but the vast majority are like, I was grossly underpaid and my career was, because that's just not the way it's been done. And I think we can change that. I think, you know, like now they're looking at more like, okay, who has massive amounts of followers on social media, that's who will book at the festival. That guarantee, you know, so now you're, it's the same thing Judd Apatow was talking about. Like when you're looking at shareholders and you're looking at profit and you have like an energy company that owns a film company, now you're just looking at algorithms and numbers and you're looking at, okay, you know, which movie should we make to get people in seats? Fast and Furious 14, here we come. And Judd Apatow was saying, but this is why we may never see like another Taxi Driver, right? We won't see all these beautiful movies, these classic films. And this is why I apply that to comedy as well. If you keep looking at shareholders and your bottom line, rather than, you know, having a solid business model, but one in which you can still promote Canadian comedians and introduce them to our country, that's a sad thing. I think that's not a great model. And I think if Just for Laughs does come back, I would love to see something akin to a star system happening in Canada, which I don't know. That might just be a pipe dream, but that's my hope.
Well said, Ali. Well said.
I just talked for 20 minutes straight. Good Lord. I'm sorry. I'm passionate about this. That's my passion. Okay, Asif, we're talking about medical tourism, and it is a bit of a, you know, misleading title, but of course, we don't know what else to call it. But when you hear medical tourism, you might think, oh, vaccines prior to travel, or touring all the great medical sites in the world, medical tourism. What we're actually talking about here is something that you might have heard over the somebody, you know, going to Mexico, for example, to get, I know you have a smarter word for it, but a stomach stapling, save a few bucks, and then it's the bariatric surgery,
yeah,
right? Example, yeah. So that kind of thing, or something that I personally know about, not that I've done it. You can look at my bald head and know that I haven't done it, but people go to Pakistan and get, you know, hair plugs or some kind of like, you know, hair replacement surgery of some kind. I haven't done it yet, but maybe after this, Asif, let's see how good, yeah, good you are at selling this to me.
Hair next year.
Oh yeah, God willing. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about medical tourism, this idea of going to another country and using their resources. I mean, in general, I'm like, do people only do this to save a few bucks? Or are they cutting a line or what it is? So I wanted to ask about, you know, if you could define medical tourism in broader terms than just bariatric surgery and hair plugs, and talk about like, what is the size? If we're talking about it, it must be something happening in huge numbers. And of course, if I know three or four people who've gone and do it, it must be like an industry.
Yeah, exactly. Industry is the right word for it. So it's been around for a long time, this idea of basically it's going outside of your own country to seek medical help. So it could be for a diagnosis, but usually it's more for a treatment or a procedure. That's usually what's going on. And we'll talk in a bit about why people might do that. But it's been around since there's historical documents from even Roman times, where Romans would visit countries like Turkey or Switzerland to look at going to, like, you know, hot natural springs that are supplied from volcanic waters, and the idea that these have healing purposes, right? So there's documentation about Romans even doing that. So we're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of years of people doing this. So it's not something that's that uncommon in history. And even now, there's some stats we have. They're not the best, but from the US, there was a study from 2007 that found in 1 year, 750,000 US patients went abroad for medical treatment, which is huge. In Canada, there was a 2017 study from the Fraser Institute. Ali, do you know the Fraser Institute? This is like,
I've heard of it many times in conversation.
It's a think tank. It is right leaning, let's say. Anything that is involved with, you know, increasing commercialization, increasing privatization, I find that's often when they publish their data. They have a ranking of public schools in Canada. And so I think the reason they do that is to, you know, try and get more money for private schools. That's my biased interpretation of the Fraser Institute. But this was looking
at... My problem with the Fraser Institute, just bringing it back to something that is near and dear to your heart, is Jerry Seinfeld's joke about think tanks. Do you remember him talking about that?
No.
It's from Comedian. And it's just this idea about, like, he's working on this joke about think tanks, about, like, just the picturing a tank where somebody gets out and goes, I think I have it. No, you think you have it. You go think about that again. Get back in there and do some more thinking.
I don't, it's funny.
You know, the idea of, like, I don't teach you to think. I don't pay you to think. Hear you. I do pay you.
You pay them to think. Yeah, I know. The whole idea of a think tank is kind of pretentious. But anyway, let's move on. But So they did a study in 2017 looking at people going outside Canada for medical care. So in 2015, they said 46,000 Canadians were medical tourists going outside the country. And in 2016, a year later, increased to 64,000. So we see this increase, and these numbers make sense. You know, in general, as a rough estimate, I say, you know, the U.S. has 10 times the population of Canada. So if we're 35 million, U.S. is 350 million. So, you know, when you see that, these numbers are similar per capita between the U.S. and Canada. So this is not a small amount of people. So the question is, why would you want to do this? And of course, the Fraser Institute, their big thing is, they hypothesize it's because of long wait times. They said in 2016, a patient could be expected to wait up to 10 weeks for a medically necessary treatment, and that would be almost 4 weeks longer than what would be considered clinically reasonable. So this is the average of, you know, looking at all these different kinds of treatments or procedures. So that is certainly a possibility, but why is it increasing now? Well, I think it has to do with globalization, right? So what do we mean by that? Well, we can get from one country to another more easily. Air travel is cheap, cheaper than it was before, more widely available. And of course, we can communicate better. I think that's what you're getting at, Ali, with the advertising that's going on. You can be in Hungary and communicate with people in Canada about why they should come to your country to get these medical procedures done, right? So it's a lot easier to do that. There's also movement of healthcare workers from middle and low income countries. A lot of those people have actually trained in high income countries and now have gone back to their other countries. So it's not like they don't have the same qualifications necessarily. There's some caveats there. We'll get to that in a second. And, you know, we know that healthcare expenditures are increasing in many countries. And so when there's economic strain on countries because they cannot provide the healthcare that people need in a timely manner, you're going to be diverted to other places, right?
Mm-hmm. I look forward to the day that I can land in Romania and say, could you look at my rash, please? My friend, well, Dr. Asif Doja, says it's a concern.
And you can see that there's other reasons why individually someone might choose, right? So it could be the cost. So for example, in the US, if they have to pay for a medical procedure because say someone doesn't have insurance, well, maybe it's easier to just go to a different country and get the same procedure and have to pay less.
I'm just looking at this article headline. I didn't read the article because that would be rude, Asif, and I'm nothing if not well-mannered. But it's a CNBC, I just clicked on medical tourism, or I typed it in, and it says, despite the pandemic and inflation, medical tourism is booming. But I don't actually understand that title, despite the pandemic and inflation. Shouldn't it be because of the pandemic and inflation? Wouldn't that?
Good question. So that's a really good point, because we were talking about costs when it comes to the US, but wait lists in Canada are more of an issue, right? People are waiting longer and longer for procedures because there is a backlog after the pandemic, right? So I think the article is trying to say, well, people maybe were hesitant to travel during the pandemic, but now we see this boom afterwards. But I think it's kind of what you're saying, Ali, like, in fact, people are waiting even longer for procedures. So why wouldn't they turn to medical tourism? So I think you have a really good point there. Sometimes it's familiarity, right? Like some people who are immigrants to, say, Canada, but from India, they're like, I'd rather just go back to India. And I have lots of patients who will tell me, we're going back to whatever home country they're from, Algeria, Lebanon, and we're just going to get this test, procedure, whatever done there. I don't care. We're just going to pay for it and go back there, you know? Because they often come from countries which have a private system in addition to a public system. And the private system in a lot of these countries, especially middle and lower income countries, is just better, right? So they're like, I'd rather just pay and go there instead of having to wait here, you know?
Well, then that does beg the question. You, as a Canadian trained doctor in the Canadian system, you hear one of your patients say that, and your patients are, you know, children and their parents. What is your reaction to that? Is that a red flag, or is...
I think people can, in the end, do whatever they want. I'm not going to necessarily tell them what to do. I often try and warn them. So let's just say, I'm just making this up, say they want to get an MRI, because the MRI would be quicker getting it done there. I'm like, okay, well, if your child needs to be sedated, because like a little kid would need to be sedated for an MRI, because they can't sit still.
Right.
Now you're not just getting an MRI there, you have to get the sedation. And is that going to be just as safe as well? So now you have the MRI there, but MRIs, like, it's not just the report that's important, it's me looking at the actual images to help with the interpretation. If I can't see the images, then they have to get them burnt onto a CD or put onto like a USB. So there are kind of some steps, and I'll get into some more examples in a couple minutes, which kind of relate more to some of the risks of doing this. By the way, another reason people travel, Ali, is for the anonymity. right? Like you said, cosmetic surgery, hair plugs, whatever. They can go someplace and, you know, there's some anonymity about going to a place where nobody knows.
Right. Them, right? But what people should know is that when you come back with hair where you didn't have hair, it's no longer anonymous. I just want to know we can see your hair plugs. Anyway, that's a different story altogether. I mentioned, you know, Mexico and Pakistan out of the gate just because those are the ones I've heard about. But are there certain countries that are associated more with certain procedures? Like, would you go to Turkey for any procedure you're looking for? Or does Turkey specify in, if you want hair, you go there. If you want this, you go there.
And I don't know about Turkey.
I just mentioned that because you mentioned historically Turkey in the springs, but that just came to mind.
Yeah, but there are some. So Singapore, for example, if you read some of these articles, is known for if you want a really high-end procedure, because Singapore is a very well-funded healthcare system, very well-trained doctors, you know, the idea of cleanliness. Everybody talks about Singapore, right? You can't chew gum in Singapore.
You spit, you know, because you're dead.
So this idea of going for high-end procedure to Singapore, Thailand apparently for cardiac, orthopedic, and gender reassignment surgery.
Oh.
You know, Eastern Europe for dental tourism apparently, like Poland for dental tourism, and Spain for fertility treatments. So it's very interesting, like different places have different niches. I've certainly heard about people going to Costa Rica and Mexico for stem cell treatments. Like we could do a whole episode on stem cell treatments, but basically there's no evidence for it. So, and there's certainly complications. And then you said mentioned bariatric surgery, which is kind of done in different places as well. So this is the stomach stapling surgery, as Ali was saying. And there are reports, Ali, and I've seen patients like this who've gone to other countries for bariatric surgery. But the problem, and this we're getting some of the issues with doing this medical tourism, is the follow-up afterwards, right? You get a procedure, and then you may stay in that country for the follow-up afterwards, or maybe you have to come home. And then what happens when you have complications? And I certainly know the surgeons who I know in Canada get very frustrated, have to deal with the fallout of some of these surgical procedures when they go wrong. And just to give you an example of bariatric surgery. So bariatric surgery, because you're doing surgery on the stomach, you could impair the absorption of the stomach to, you know, for micronutrients and things like that, right? And so you have to supplement people with things like vitamin D, calcium, iron, a multivitamin, but most importantly, B12. And if you don't supplement people with B12, you can get severe neurologic issues affecting your brain, spinal cord. And so we've seen patients who were just not told that they have to take B12 and end up with neurologic complications afterwards.
I kind of know, I can relate to this. I once tried to change a tap in my kitchen sink and it didn't work. And the plumber was very angry with me for trying to do the work myself. I'm just kidding. I never did that, Asif. I never did that. I'm just trying to relate to something I can't relate to. But yeah, I can imagine. But you are obliged as a doctor here to deal with the fallout. You can't
course,
be like, go back
course.
And write.
No, of course but not. It's just of course not. But it is frustrating because, you know, in the end, these are people, right? Who are, you know, they're trying to do the right thing for themselves, let's say. But I don't know. You just want people to be treated well, you know, and not end up having complications. But let's talk a bit about some of these complications that we can see. Some of them are more ethical, Ali. So this idea of fertility tourism, which we talked about, I guess in Spain is a common one. But I've heard of it in, and Spain is, you know, has had some economic troubles, but I would not say it's necessarily a poor country. But there are people who go to places like India for their fertility treatment, especially when it comes to surrogates or people donating their eggs, right? And one of the issues is, you know, are we really being fair and ethical with this idea of fertility tourism? Because women in these recipient countries may be compelled because of their poverty to donate eggs or act as surrogates. And is it really, you know, being done with full consent of theirs, you know, or is it under duress because they really need money, right? And we're talking astronomical sums when you compare it to what their income might be in a place like India. So that's important too. You could think about the effect on countries themselves. And one thing is actually good is that people talk about our brain drain, right? In medicine, where doctors who are from other countries, say they come to Canada to train and then they just stay in Canada. And so you get a really smart person from a different country who's now staying here instead of going back to their country to help their country. But you can think that if a doctor comes here to Canada trained, then goes back to their home country, now they have Canadian training, so they can attract people from Canada. Say, come to our country. I have full Canadian training, and I can do this procedure for you and generate money, not just for the country, but for themselves as a physician. So they can, you can get this reverse brain drain, which would be good. But you could also imagine that there could be an increase in inequities in a country, right? When you're catering to the tourists, but what about the people in your own country who need medical help, right? And you could be then increasing doctors in the private sector and having less people in the public sector. This is the whole reason why people are concerned about public versus private medicine in Canada, because you could be drawing away people from the public system. Well, even worse in a place that has medical tourism, right? Another thing that you'd be interested, Ali, and we'll put some links to some of these articles where they
talk about— Is it about a butt lift?
Don't mention
my butt lift if you notice it. That is
private. I'm actually going to talk about butt lifts in just a second. Well, so there's a good segue. But before we get to that, it's interesting to look at some of these websites or the advertising for these clinics, because they don't give a lot of information about follow-up care or what to do if you get a complication, which that's some of the examples I was giving you.
But that's weird, because that's an extra source of revenue. It's weird that they don't, because now you can have somebody come back for follow-up appointments or something, right?
But if people are spending money out of their own pocket, they want to be one and done, right? They want to get the procedure and then leave.
You don't mention, you know, the B12, as you said, which is such a basic thing to just easily, you know, mention. Mm-hmm. Now you have a deeply unsatisfied, potentially, you know, somebody with their health damaged in a significant way. That's very bad press for your practice abroad and your country, I would imagine.
Well, yeah, a lot of these ads point to an emphasis on testimonies from patients, or saying, you know, oh, come to Costa Rica and go in a rainforest tour and go to the beach in addition to getting your procedure done, or saying, you know, we offer treatment that's as good as your home country, right? But maybe they should be focusing more on, are they formally accredited? What are their safety issues? What are their hygiene issues? What's the qualification of the doctors that you're being there, right? But they kind of, you can see it's more like literally like tourism, right? As opposed to, you know, selecting someone because of their medical skills. But Ali wanted to talk about a butt lift. So we're going to talk about a tummy tucks and Brazilian butt lifts. I don't actually know what a Brazilian butt lift is.
I'm just going to get my pen. Just 1 second. Take some notes here. Yep.
Because this is an interesting study that just came out last month in the New England Journal of Medicine. Okay, so they were looking at people who had fungal meningitis. Okay, so we're talking about an invasion of a fungus into your brain and spinal cord. The meninges are the coatings around your brain and spinal cord, and then you have fluid in there, and they had fungus which was infecting them. And they happened to find this in 3 Texas hospitals. This is a very rare fungal strain that is almost unheard of in America. So 13 cases, 9 died, okay? And these are very sick. They were all mainly young women in their 20s and 30s. And
what did they have in common?
They had been to Mexico, in the same place in Mexico, for tummy tucks or Brazilian butt lifts between January 1st and May 13th, 2023. So the article just came out, but this happened at the beginning of last year.
It's a very bad sales pitch.
It was 2 clinics, but they were kind of related. The clinics were related from my point of view. So what they think is that the women had to have an epidural. So epidural is what people would get, a spinal anesthesia, which, you know, you get when you're having a baby most commonly. But you can do it for these procedures as well, because as long as you're anesthetizing your abdomen and below, then you could get a tummy tuck, butt lift, whatever. And they think that the epidural medications were tainted by this fungus. So the fungus entered the spinal fluid and worked its way up to the brain.
Yeah.
And these patients started after, you know, a few weeks after their surgery, they started getting headaches and fevers. And then they got more and more complications and became comatose. And so there was, you know, a lot of death. And the problem with this fungus is they tried all the regular antifungal medicines, and none of them worked. The fungus was resistant to all of these. So they had
so
rare
treatment. That they haven't done any research.
Yeah. And so they finally were able to try experimental medication, and some of the patients were doing okay on the experimental medication. So it's a bit of a, you know, a horror story about the risks of doing this, medical tourism. It's, you know, and you could say, well, couldn't you have complications in Canada? Well, probably not of this super rare fungus going into your spinal fluid. But I don't know. I think you just have to be really cautious about going overseas. I personally, who knows? I'm saying this right now. Would I ever do this? Maybe if I had to wait a really long time for a procedure that I thought was necessary. I don't know. Maybe, but I would just have such a hard time going somewhere else, especially if I had concerns about either the qualifications of the physicians or the actual cleanliness and hygiene of the materials they used or the clinics themselves. Just really, really scary.
Mm-hmm. That's quite a buzzkill, I must say, and I will cancel my flight to Brazil right now.
That's our episode for today. Let us know what you guys thought about our topics today. Just for Laughs. Any other questions about the Just for Laughs Festival? What is Ollie going to do this July? Who knows? Also... He doesn't know. Let us know about medical tourism. There's other kinds of medical tourism as well. In Canada, there's people going from one province to another and paying privately. There's also something which we'll talk about in a future episode, which is a different kind of medical tourism. This is medical students going abroad to do placements, especially in low-income countries. And there are some ethical issues about doing that as well. Sometimes, you know, medical students go there and they're allowed to do procedures on patients that they would never in a million years be allowed to do as a medical student in North America. But then suddenly they're in, say, an African country, and they are. So that's a different kind of medical tourism, which we'll save for a future episode. Ali, anything going on in April?
No, but remember, stem cell research and that different type of medical tourism. Take note.
Ali wants us to talk about those things. And we should talk about fertility as a bigger topic in the future. We have a lot of interviews coming up that you guys have heard over the past couple of weeks, a few more coming up in the next couple of months as well. But remember that although I'm a doctor, I'm not your doctor. Medical issues we talk about are for your interest and information only, and they're not medical advice. Please consult your medical professionals for actual medical advice. Thanks for listening.
Mommy, it's over. That's a callback, you see? That's a callback to the Just for Laughs.
Oh, slogan. Yeah, that little, what is that? What is that character? It's like an imp
Victor.
Or a...
Victor. It's Victor, buddy. Victor
is... What is he, a gremlin?
He's Victor. Victor is dead. We have to attend Victor's funeral at some point, probably. He was the mascot of Just for Laughs.
Just anyway. One final bummer for the end of this episode. Bye. Thank you.